Are you tired of juggling contacts, manually following up, and deals falling through the cracks? We can fix it so you never lose another lead, enabling 24/7 sales and support via an AI that learns your business. Ready to close more deals with less hassle? Get a free trial of our marketing automation at thebuzzcrm.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Richard Zwicker of the Green Peak. And joining us today, we've got Kyle Nethery, who is the CEO of Samsung Extracts. Welcome aboard the Green Peak, Kyle.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about Samsung.
Yeah, so Samsung Extracts started around 2019 in that time frame. We're in probably what you would call like deep southeast Alabama, probably roughly an hour or 15 minutes from Panama City Beach. So we're right on kind of that Florida-Alabama line, just to give you concept. Not a lot of hemp companies around us. Especially when we start looking southeast. But I started here in 2022, and a lot of that focus was us getting to high scalability. Us as a plant, you know, we're probably extracting roughly 16 to 18,000 pounds a week. A lot of that had to do with kind of one of the classic cases you see in the cannabis industry where, you know, you procure equipment or work with folks and that equipment doesn't work out as prospected and so forth. But we had to work with what we had. So, you know, re-engineering a lot of equipment, making it work for what we wanted to do to reach in pretty high scale, you know, running around the 250,000 pounds a month of hemp products.
250,000 pounds wet? How much dried?
Dry.
250,000 pounds wet?
Dry. Yes, 250,000 pounds a month dry.
Okay.
On our side with biomass procured across the country. And our focus is CBD.
Okay.
We focus on CBD exclusively. We don't even really look at CBG and some of the other non-psychoactive cannabinoids, but we're not in the party of your Delta 8s and products like that. So kind of the way we see it is we're betting all our money on CBD isolate from the long game, and whether that's for consumption use or topical use, but even other types of applications in the industrial sector that those things can provide. So yeah, really just a rough and dirty business strategy. We try to run as much biomass as we can. We try to get as much CBD out as we can and then put that into the marketplace.
So what's your extraction process?
Yeah, so it's actually kind of exciting. So it's a lot different than what you would typically see. You know, if you've been in marijuana extraction processes or more smaller lab based, you know, where you might be operating around, you know, 1500 to 3000 square feet of C1D2 or C1D1 space. Ours is completely outside. So we mimic way more visually to what you'd see in like the midstream oil and gas processing space from some of the equipment we use. Like, for example, our distillation tower is about 4 stories tall. In the regulated marijuana space, mine was the size of double doors.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of differences you see from that, from just like, we don't have equipment that was made for the cannabis industry. A lot of our equipment was made for oil and gas processing, large agricultural, industrial pieces like that. So,
and it is a completely different. Even though you end up with CBD, it, when you're dealing with pure hemp and you're extracting in bulk like that, it is a different model and business.
Yeah, and it's like there's sometimes I tell people that I don't feel like I'm in the cannabis industry. That to me is a unique one because I feel like I'm much more in agricultural processing. From what we do. And so even just like when you think about certain things is in a traditional cannabis and industry company, a lot of your equipment is very plug and play. Ours takes lots of engineering and lots of moving around. You know, it's nothing to be on our site and see a 30 horsepower motor that's running a pump that's helping move fluid from process to process. But the one piece of this side of the business that has been the most like, side of it is just waste creation. You know, in the marijuana industry, you usually have like a secure dump. You threw some of your waste in, you know, if you put kitty litter or vegetable oil in it or those types of things.
Yep.
Just the tremendous amount of waste we have.
Yep.
Whether it's spent biomass or bottoms from distillation or fat removal during the winterization process or protein removal. There's just so much byproduct.
Right.
You really can get lost in it and you have to stay on top of it because it stacks up tremendously fast. So that's been the part that surprised me the most. But from an extraction methodology.
And what do you do? How do you handle it?
So with the spent biomass is probably one of the more interesting conversations that we've kind of R&D'd. So within our sister companies and our owner, we operate, you know, north of 25,000 acres of productive farmland. And that's in the form. We don't grow much hemp because Alabama can be a tough climate.
Yep.
But for the most part, you'll see that be in the form of peanuts, cotton, soybeans, you know, mostly row crop based agriculture we do. We also operate sod farms, cattle, timber, all those things. But one of the things we saw their spend biomass in the last couple of years is we've been sampling, using it as a pre-plant fertilizer and kind of get side-by-side comparisons between commercial pre-plant fertilizer and just our spent biomass that's already been extracted. And specifically in our cotton crop, we actually saw better performance with our spent biomass. And so
right.
this year, we're getting ready to put in a large pelletizing operation to where we could, I call it the Bluebell model, but we'd make a certain amount of pelletized biomass so that our farms could make that useful for their crop. We need to pelletize it so you can broadcast evenly.
Yep.
And then we'd also have a retail bagging line that would come off that and 2 pound, 5 bag, 5 pound bag type samples that could enter into the marketplace for farmers or, you know, just people, residential, hobby type grow people and things like that. And so that's been a pretty cool, I mean, it's nothing for us to get people coming by asking for a 5 gallon bucket of the stuff so that they can put it on their, you know, little 10 foot tomato patch. But
yep,
that's that piece. The fats and the protein side, it's one of the more interesting ones that we've kind of looked at because we do have a wide amount of applications. You know, whether we've discussed, do we want to try to put that towards a soap-based product where you can almost create a soap that's solely from hemp? But I think the one piece that's the most practically applicable for us is for our cattle operations. You know, our operations usually carry about 6,000 head of cattle.
Right.
Gamma would get more speedy to the hemp being used as a proper feed mill for cows. We actually would have the whole entire formula because we could have the spent biomass as a filler, and then you have protein and fats that's extracted from hemp that could actually be homogenized into a simple feed.
Yeah, it is amazing. I know I went through that down in Colombia and ways to use that and to use it both as a feed and then I was using cannabis, not hemp. So you had different separation, but then creating also the right fertilizing products out of it and the whole preparation and cleaning, right?
Yeah.
So that you weren't actually restoring back pathogens back to the plant. So you had to actually, the process was quite involved, but if you got it right, you know, it became really a very climate friendly, but carbon friendly process.
Yeah. And that's even like a whole nice piece to it as well. So like we're an ethanol extraction based facility. We actually have achieved, for the longest time, we didn't do cold extraction. We were extraction ambient temperatures in Alabama, South Alabama specifically. And so we're dealing with high heat, high humidity. And so we'd had a lot of those ambient factors act onto our equipment. But that's another good thing about our process is using that ethanol and the spent biomass, drying it. We actually have a nice well-sanitized product with that biomass from, you know, ethanol provides that. But yeah, ethanol facility, but we started extracting cold outside at -20 about 3 months ago. So we achieved that outside in ambient temperatures.
Huh, that's excellent.
Yep.
That's excellent. Cool. And so you mentioned earlier that when you started, you were running about 16,000 pounds a month. What are you up to now?
Right now it's at that 250,000 pound a month target. I'd say like for 2025, the battle cry from our side is 500,000 pounds a month. So that's what we're pushing to. We're doubling our production system. We're adding in some other efficiencies that we drag in from a bottleneck perspective, whether that be solvent evaporation or going to more high intensity chillers for winterization.
Right.
We've entered into this mode where I kind of talk about is like, the first year when we were here, we were trying to evaluate, like, can we do what we want to do? And that's
right.
And from point A and then get it out to sellable product. That was really the theme of year one. Year two is all about scalability. It's about driving high pounds up, getting as much output. Because when you're in a large scale operation, your margin comes from output and having a lot of output, so you can wash your overhead out effectively. The third theme we had, I'd say, was quality focus. Now that we know we can do it at high amounts, now we focused on quality. That's really been what we spent the last year on, and that's increasing winterization capabilities, working on being able to see our CIP, our equipment, even better so that we do have
right.
Output, and then focusing on distillation so we can become more precise on boiling points in our system. But now we're back to now that we can do it at high scale, we have quality. Now it's going back to the scale piece, and that's right. going to be kind of the 2025 battle cry.
And your output products, you sell distillate, isolate, both?
We sold distillate for a little bit, but the goal was always isolate. Year one, we were here. We had some engineers do a not great job on our isolation system. And so we kind of racked our brains for the last bit. And we met a really solid chemical process engineer in Mobile, Alabama, which is about 2 hours west of us. And he's a very simple engineer, not your typical engineer type. And it's been a great blend. And we worked with him to design our isolation system. And we bought nothing we built our system with was new. We bought all used equipment, built our system out of that. We built it in about 6 weeks, and we kept it under about $125,000 from a project perspective. With, if you know, new equipment cannabis numbers, I mean, that's probably
hard. Oh, it's incredibly expensive. It needn't be, right? That's the thing.
But one thing about us is we don't buy new equipment.
Right.
We buy old equipment. I'll give you an example.
Which fortunately now there's a lot available on the market.
For sure.
There wasn't a couple of years ago.
but what's great in our space is we don't buy cannabis equipment, you know? Right. So like we're cross industrial from like our prospect buying. So we actually have a large used equipment network even beyond cannabis. And I'll give you an example. It was like one issue we used to run into was we would have, there's no good standard when it comes to harvesting hemp. You know, right. If you're in Western Kentucky versus Eastern Kentucky, there's massive differences in how they do processing. And then when you start moving muscles, so we had to create a system that could eat any variety of process methodology, anywhere from 20% stem to 2% stem, mill to not mill to
right.
all these different varieties that we had. And so we found it's called an agri chopper, but it's basically like a farm-based fail buster where if they go to pull hay and it chops it up. I found one of those in Montreal laying in a field for like $3,000.
Oh, yeah.
Threw it on a truck and we rebuilt the whole thing, put it into our system. And that's probably like new. That's probably like a $50,000 piece of equipment new.
Sure. Would make sense.
We like to think that we're pretty scrappy operators when it comes to that. You know, we spend very little CapEx and compared to a lot of our competition, but we've got our own welding team. We have our own electricians. That's been one big value prop we have as an operator. And we're rough and dirty and we're scrappy. And that's how we do things.
Well, I'd like to come back to that. We do have to take a short break. But when we come back, I'd like to talk more about how you identified where to make those changes and the process by which you followed. Because it's not just an engineering question. It's a question in terms of, as you're going through a GMP process, how do you tie that accountability every stage and where do you insert those changes? But we'll come to that when we come back after a short break on the Green Peak. I'm Richard Zwicky with Kyle Nethery. And we're back on the Green Peak with Kyle Nethery from Samson Extracts. And Kyle, before the break, we were talking about the fact that, you know, when you joined the company back in 22, one of the things you looked at and analyzed was the equipment and the flow of the materials through the process and how to rebuild it without a ton of CapEx, but how to do it wisely so that you maintained a GMP process. And you mentioned, you know, acquiring a piece of equipment out of Montreal, but that's one piece. How did you approach that analysis walking in? Because there's the existing operation with the inertia and there's where you needed to get. You couldn't stop. So what'd you do?
Yeah. And it's funny too, because I would say like in the first 3 months here, a lot of their issues were more surrounding just employee discipline type problems. And what I mean by discipline, I don't mean like punishment. I mean, doing the right thing at the right time. Like it's self-discipline. It's like one of our issues we had that was a big one.
Which is fundamental to GMP because you have to follow the same process every single time, right? It's a process. It's a process certification.
Yeah. And even prior to, even when you think about a sub-level of GMP was, you know, I remember my first week I got here, I'd started like on Monday and like Wednesday we weren't producing. And so I'd do the floor walk. It's like, why aren't we running anything? It's like, well, we don't have any ethanol. It's like, why don't we have any ethanol? And
right.
It takes 2 weeks to get. And it's like, why don't we order it 2 weeks ago? So there was a lot of those issues where it's just having people focus on doing the right thing at the right time so they could actually, you can get out what you can get out.
Right.
That was a big one. But the big piece was, so I'm Lean Six Sigma certified, and so I've been in the space of lean manufacturing and lean processes for a long time. But the biggest piece that I had to do in any type I go in a situation is I have to fully understand what's going on. I'm
right.
not I'm a big believer in is that if I'm going to make changes, if I'm going to tell people to do things a certain way, I actually have to go work the processes myself. So I always do that at the beginning. Yep. I put on the work clothes and I go do the nasty work, because not only do I want to understand from a pure processing perspective what's a difficulty, but I need to understand what the true employee sentiment is of what they're having to go through. You know, and if an employee's saying, oh, well, there's this thing and it's making things take four times as long, wherever these problems are, it's like, I want to go understand that. So I can, if I think it's painful, it's unfair for me to make someone else do that. And I have to make a change there. So that's always kind of like the first part of my process. But the big one was immediate bottleneck identification. And that was the one. So it's like, if you said, when I got here, there's about seven stations. Let's just say we had seven process stations amongst our flow.
Yep.
Well, three of those stations had unlimited capacity at that time. And really, it was just three other stations that were dragging that capacity backward. I mean, because it's the whole, you're only as strong as your weakest link. You can only move as fast as your slowest process.
Right.
Those are always my first attacks. And that was where we did. So they had a huge bottleneck on loading biomass and on that. And we made some improvements to speed that piece up. Then winterization was taking forever. So it's like, well, what can we do to speed up winterization while we're still counteracting quality? And so those are always my processes. And what's nice is because of the size and scale of our facility, it's not like at that time, it was not a continuous loop, continuous flow system. So you have to put biomass into point A and then you get crude out on point Z. They were broken up in a way that actually was effective. So if I said, hey, I need to work on process three, I can still run process one, two, four, five, six, and seven while I'm putting work in on process three. We could still have productive elements to what we're trying to do to move inventory through the WIP system. And so that actually made it easy to enable. So we didn't have to say, oh, facility shut down for a week. We got to work on this like piece of equipment. So that enabled us to actually move pretty fast. And we've connected those systems as time's gone on and we've gotten smarter about automation and process flow and things like that. Right now in our current state, it's much more harder to do that because our interconnectivity of processes. And so if we're going down to do a project, it actually is a much more substantial downtime event that we have to take into account from a cost perspective.
Right. And the solutions were they, because you've touched on a couple of different aspects about people not planning ahead and then technology. Was it really a balance between the technology and the people? Was it a training issue? Where did you find the biggest gains, and what were the things that surprised you that you had to address?
Yeah, so there's always gains when you get people when you're drawing awareness to getting people to perform functions at certain times. You'll always have gains there to some extent. And it's the easiest fruit to grab off the tree whenever you're good at those kinds of things. But our biggest gains were, and it had to go into, it was with the initial engineer's methodology of the system.
Yep.
So the folks that made our system came from the juicing world out of Florida, right? And so there was a massive underestimation of the viscosity and the difficulty when dealing with hemp extracts compared to what we're dealing in the orange juice space.
Yep.
So what we realized with our production system was there wasn't enough heating. You need a ton of heating to move CBD crude, CBD distillate, CBD extracts. You can't do it without heating. I challenge anyone to do it without heating. It is impossible.
Right.
So that was the first piece, is we had to have heavily integrated heating so we can actually take fluid from point A to point B to point C, and it can actually move the system. The combo factor on our system at the beginning was the piping was incredibly small. You know, right now, we've probably got half a mile of stainless steel piping with the right process system that we have now. We'd have piping that was a quarter inch wide, a half inch wide. So then you have undersized heating going through undersized piping. And this is like long strips of pipe. It's not right. Like if you get a clog, I mean, that's a 16-foot clog that you have to try to figure out how to get in, because that if you have a semi-warm crude oil that's going through piping, it's going to harden and you can't really melt it back unless you're getting torches out. And you're just, so those are really, when I say like the two themes of like massive change was pipe sizing and heating in our system so we'd actually move the fluid. And those are kind of like pretty easy things to do and change for the most part. You know what you're doing to make those changes.
And they're easy problems to avoid if you're really planning ahead and know what's what, right? Yeah. And do you think it was constrained because the prior, you mentioned that the extractors came out of the orange juice area. And is it just inexperience, or was it something else? It's always interesting to see why businesses would make a mistake and then how they rectify.
We were their pilot.
Okay.
That was really a big issue. So there wasn't validation. The whole production system was invalidated. We were that manufacturing's pilot, and they were great people, smart guys. But in their defense, when we were having those issues, was I can't go down to the public library and buy a book on how to process hemp. You know, that's
yeah.
You know, so there's not a lot of this groundwork. We know, you know, we certainly know this here and this here, but when you're trying to build a high scale operation and you're making a bit of guesswork on it, like you're going to run into interference there that reduces your ability to execute. And that's really what I would say thematically was, it was just, they didn't know what they didn't know. The part that was tough is what you didn't know are probably two of the most critical pieces to making that a successful system.
Right. And I mean, the reality is learning is all about mistakes.
Yeah.
The question is, what step are you at for learning and how fast do you iterate?
100%.
Right.
100%, yeah.
So as you, you know, from 22 to now, you've gone from the 1600 pounds to a quarter of a million. How's the team size changed?
Really not that much. So when I got here, we were at around 34 people. And now we kind of float around 36 to 38, depending on certain variables of attrition.
Right.
So, you know, it's a little bit of an increase, you know, it's roughly 50% increase, let's call it, on the workforce side. But the big difference there, and why I say it's really not that much, is, you know, when we started here, we ran one shift 5 days a week. We're 24/7 operation now. So the lights never go off. We work over holidays. We have four teams that run production with alternating 12-hour schedules. And so, but our big difference is our ability with, you know, bringing our own welding staff, our own electrical staff, our automation is tremendous. And what's enabling that is, so we don't have to see massive increases in headcount because we've built in those level. Now that we know what's going on, we let the machines do what they want to do, which ties me back to, that is another issue we had with the original system. Just to go back for a second, is they tried to put in too much automation before they made the system work. That is like a huge issue in the production space, where I'm a big believer in, is I want to be able to make the system perfect with like manual valves, manual temperature increases. They kind of baked in automation at the beginning. And so when you couldn't make the system work, you almost couldn't unwind it in a way, because all that equipment and all those automated valves, automated sensors, all these things were living on the brains of the PLC. And so if you're in a problem, you're kind of like, I don't know what to do. I can't just turn the valve.
You don't know where it is at that point.
100%.
Figured out. You do have to, you know, automation is fantastic. And my business in Colombia, the old greenhouse, which was 100,000 square feet, and then a 500,000 one outdoors, but the indoor one was automated. But before it could get there, everything had to be done by hand and every issue figured out. Otherwise, exactly what you're saying, something goes wrong and where? You don't know where to begin.
Yeah, and that's where a lot of people don't have great insights to those to what you're talking about. What I mean by that is whenever we get inundated with various forms of automation in our lives, whether it's cell phones or vehicles and all these things, and people's like, well, I just do this and it does that, you know,
right.
I just press this and it does this. Well, and that's great, but there's a whole back end to it that people, I get, probably just don't have the awareness into it, where when you're in a production system with automation, you have to know specifically why is it doing what it's doing.
Right.
And that's what's been good about where we've gotten, is we write our programs actually at a slow pace. Well, our electrician can write our own program. So we say, all right, we know how to do all of this manual. Let's make it do this one thing. Let's write the rule and make it do this one thing. Okay, that works. All right, well, what if it could do this now? And you're always writing your programming logic by kind of like small victories within your process, rather than just like unpacking this like major automation event. So if something quirky happens, you're kind of like, I don't know why it just did that. We can actually say, oh, well, remember when we wrote this rule, that's why it's doing that. So we actually have a firm understanding of the kind of the engines of our automation, so that we can troubleshoot automation very well too.
Right.
And I think that's a huge win for us as an operator.
That is a huge win. It's massive, because it does allow that nimbleness to continue in perpetuity down, right? We do have to take another short break, Kyle, but when we come back, I want to just chat briefly about your future expansion, and also Wiregrass, which is a new product.
Yeah.
We'll be back on the Green Peak in just a minute. I'm Richard Zwicky with Kyle Nethery. And we're back on the Green Peak with Kyle Nethery from Samson Extracts. And Kyle, you know, we're chatting about some of the business processes and how you've optimized the system. That sets the stage for expansion. And the markets around the world are opening up. You know, we had Stephen Murphy with Prohibition Partners on just recently, and the growth in Germany is phenomenal. I know that the growth in South America has been quite amazing in terms of where, what it's coming to and where it was. Still lots to go. Samson's looking at the international markets. Of course, the international markets are more complicated. The regulatory framework is much more stringent. And you're dealing with the cost production basis, which are much lower overseas than in the U.S. to reach those pharmaceutical standards. How are you looking at it?
Well, you know, and it's been the international pursuits when we've looked at them from a selling perspective is it's, you know, everyone thinks the U.S. has this huge level of complexity to how their operation is. But I mean, you enter into another dimension when you go amongst other countries because everyone's talking about the patchwork of laws in this country. Well, it's like, go start talking to other countries and you'll get even more. You'll see even more
difference. The U.S. stringents are lax by comparison to most of the international market.
100%. And it's just differences, you know, like this country's good with 1%. This country's, you know, 0%. Yep. You know, and there's all of these understandings that you have to maneuver on the international side. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, those are inroads we're trying to make now. And we still feel really good with our domestic base from an output perspective, and we're confident there. But the biggest key for us, the way we see it is we've had to, in terms of differentiator, especially in 2024, is put a heavy influence on straight-to-farmer contracting when it comes to hemp.
Right.
That's one of the large challenges when you looked in 22 to 23. Where a lot of it was older hemp from 1920 supply. Yes, it was cheap, but it also came with a barrel of fish hooks of difficulty from a procurement and logistics perspective.
You want predictability.
Yeah, and it really was. I mean, I did a segment at MJ BizCon in Vegas a couple weeks ago when we were there, and I tell people all the time, it's like in the marijuana side, everyone complains about metric and how hard it is to use. You know how much I want to have metric in the hemp space right now and how much that would make my life.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what we spent a lot of time on. And so we went to contract this year for 3 million pounds. And that's where we're going to have a lot of our efficiencies is being able to work direct with farmer. And we're cutting a lot of the middle costs that come associated with brokers and the uncertainty that are there. And so that's where really at this time of where I'm at in the company, I'm probably spending close to a quarter, if not 30% of my time on farmer relationships, being
right
at the farm in Kentucky and establishing those relationships, because that's, When I look over the last 3 years, one of the biggest level uncertainties is biomass supply. And that's either whether you can have confidence in that biomass supply or you can have confidence that's going to be delivered to you. And so that's where we've got a great grower base in Kentucky. You know, roughly about 50% of our biomass will come out of the state of Kentucky this year. But
right. That
is really one of our competitive factors, even when we look domestically, is we've always been a company that's inventoried pretty high. And the more we can get to the farmer, for us, we're a very farmer-focused company, and making sure that they're getting a price that wins for them and we get a price that wins for us.
Right.
It's hard to find that sometimes in those broker-based environments. But
absolutely.
But to go back to the international side, is we're trying to find where those efficiencies can be at.
Right.
You know,
that's good.
There isn't a great price difference between the two. Because, you know, you would think that is like, if I go international, I'm going to be able to sell this for 2x of what I can sell domestically. And that's kind of not the case. And it's for a number of reasons. Is there's a lot of people shipping internationally. And like you said, countries are opening up.
Yeah.
And
hemp is different than cannabis, where you can drive the cost down. Because I know I drove it down to 7 cents a gram. But if I were working with hemp, I'd be able to shave a penny off, because it's a complete different type of operation. And you are at an industrial scale, as opposed to, you know, it's always going to be smaller on cannabis. We do have to end the segment, but one thing I'd like to ask quickly and invite people to look at is give us 30 seconds about Wiregrass and then how people can learn more.
Yeah, so Wiregrass is a skincare line that we launched, and that's a space that we want to live in as a topical base. I mean, it's hard to compete in CBD when it comes to the ingestible side, because customers do want psychoactive effects, and we do understand that. So it's a skincare line that we integrated with skincare with CBD in those products, but it also has the other elements to the products that are beneficial in normal skincare. We're also looking at sun, certain type of repellents for insects, things like that. But that's where, when it comes to a true product side, that's where we kind of see green grass ahead.
Yep. And people want to learn more about Samson and on wiregrass, where can they learn more?
Yeah, websites are very easy. They're www.samsonextracts.com and then wiregrasswellness.com are two sites that offer those products, one for more of the bulk extracts, one for the product side. And yeah, and that's that. And we're also on social media, same type of titles that we have company-wise and so forth.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for joining us this week on the Green Peak, Kyle.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me.
And thanks to everybody for listening. If you want to learn more, please look up Samson Extracts online. I'm Rich Zwicky on the Green Peak. We'll be back again with you soon.